The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, with the November elections fast approaching, we'll look at primary results from Tuesday's contest in New York State and Florida.
I think you're very right to point out what happened in Florida about the school boards in this flip.
We will hear from Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis.
We were in some conservative areas that had school boards that were way out of step with the voters there.
The president announces his plan to forgive up to $300 billion of student debt.
We're taking an economically responsible course.
Beyond the irresponsible spending, there's a moral issue.
What kind of a lesson are we teaching young people? Yeah.
My colleague Mike Gallagher weighs in.
They don't earn votes over at the Democrat side of things. They buy them.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We will begin with a look at the primaries. The November election will be on us before we know it. It should be about six things. Things you may have heard or read from me already. The three A's, affordability, anxiety, and anger. And the three E's, energy, education, and ESG. On Tuesday this past week, New York State and Florida held their primaries. Legacy media outlets were pointing to the win of Democrat Pat Ryan over Republican Mark Molinaro in a special election in New York's 19th congressional district. I was looking at the turnout numbers and turned to Leland Vitter of News Nation.
But 133,000 people voted. Democrats are dancing around saying it's a Roe v. Wade election. In fact, less than 2 years ago, 343,000 people voted in that race, Leland. So what does that tell you about the importance of a special election in August in upstate New York?
You've got enormous voter enthusiasm. I would say the Democrats have a point that there is a Roe component to this turnout. We saw it in Kansas, and I think you'd be remiss not to think about it in New York to get those kinds of numbers coming out in the middle of a special election in August.
I'm going to disagree with you, Leland. If you drop off from 343 in the general to 133, even though I think that shows that all the abortion activists showed up, I just don't think it doesn't mean that abortion motivates as many people as they think when they go from 343 to 133.
Well, I think you can make that argument if it was a general to general. I don't know about general to special when it's a primary. But either way, I think that what you're seeing, if you're going 50 to 48, in that, and this is one of the true swing districts, I think you still have to say that Democratic enthusiasm is coming up. Is it coming up to the level that Democrats want it to come up? I don't think so. But if we go across the board and expand this out to what we're seeing in the polls in a number of swing state Senate races as well, the red wave that we were told was building and building momentum just doesn't seem to be there.
Oh, Leland, you and I have a disagreement. I look down at the Florida school district races where Ron DeSantis has won at least 21 out of 30 school board races against incumbents. That is, to me, the edge of the red wave. Of course, DeSantis rolled. The abortion activist candidate in the Democratic primary down there lost to Charlie Crist, who's right on abortion but didn't campaign on abortion. Freed lost, rather, got blown out. I think they are... The Manhattan Beltway media block wants it to be an abortion election, and it just isn't. And I think their high watermark is New York's special last night. And that was one third of a general election turnout, even though they were all up in arms about Dobbs. So it's just a different take.
I think you're very right to point out what happened in Florida about the school boards in this flip, in the school boards to Republican-dominated school boards. That's motivating to a big part of the electorate. And I think you're right to point out Nikki Fried losing in Florida as well. Tip of the red wave. be really interesting to see if you are right. I would put to you, though, how do you explain Fetterman up double digits in Pennsylvania, if that's true? How do you explain it as close as it is in Ohio, with some polls having Tim Ryan up? How do you explain Ron Johnson down in Wisconsin? How do you explain Herschel Walker?
You raised my perfect question, Leland. Wisconsin, ABC, Washington Post poll a week before the election, 2020, Joe Biden was going to win by 17 points. He won by 0.6 points. Polling is broken. They do not get Republicans and rural voters to pick up the phone. They can't figure it out. So Fetterman's no more up 11 points than I can fly a jet plane. JD's not going to lose Ohio. And Tim Ryan's a friend of mine. It's just a deep red state. I think the business is broken.
I am convinced that school board wins across Florida state are a pretty good bellwether for the fall election, because education is one of the key issues on the mind of the electorate. Let me remind you, education was absolutely a key component of now Governor Glenn Youngkin's win in Virginia last November. In Florida, Governor DeSantis was very much hands-on in endorsing school board candidates. Governor DeSantis was my guest on my program.
How did you do on Tuesday in the school board elections in which you intervened?
So we did 30 different candidates that we endorsed and gave support. 25 of them won the primaries, and we were in some conservative areas that had school boards that were way out of step with the voters there. And then we were also in tougher terrain because we think it's important if people are doing the right thing. But in Florida, under our state constitution, school board elections are nonpartisan. And so what that has meant over the years is that the special interest and the unions will back a candidate in these red counties. They'll dress them up as if they represent conservative values. But then when they get on the board, they're basically doing, you know, left-wing things. And so we said, okay, we want to make sure Republican voters in particular know who's the candidate that's standing there that doesn't want schools to be used as tools of indoctrination, that believes in the basic values of the community, and that believes that parents have an important role in that. So we were able to highlight a lot of that. And so we ended up flipping seats in places like Miami-Dade County, Sarasota, Hillsborough, Duval County, very important parts of our state. And now what you have, Hugh, and this has been building for the last year and a half, but what you have is, there's a lot of Republican voters that actually are engaged in school board races. And it's not just parents, because I think other Republicans who maybe have kids that have already grown up and are gone with the school system, they just understand how important this is. And so I think the fact that, first of all, that we had schools open and that we were standing with parents all throughout COVID to make sure that their kids had opportunity gave us a lot of credibility to then go into these communities and say, hey, here's a candidate that's going to stand for the policies that you wanted to see over the last year and a half.
Governor, every time I bring up the ideological agendas that have seeped into high school and elementary schools, I hear from my left-wing friends in the media, oh, CRT is not taught in the schools. I point them to liberals of TikTok, and they say that's simply the amplification of a few outliers. In fact, that ideology is everywhere. How do you respond when lefties say, hey, CRT, it's a graduate level stuff, got nothing to do with teaching?
Well, it's true. There aren't courses named CRT. What it is, it's a pedagogy that is used to infuse normal academic subjects. So, for example, teaching history, the New York Times 1619 Project instructs teachers to teach that the American Revolution was fought to defend slavery. Now, that's false. We know why the American Revolution was fought. They wrote pamphlets about it. They debated it. And they laid down a lot of markers that have really changed the course of human history. And quite frankly, made sure that slavery's days were numbered, because they actually said our rights come from God, we're all created equal. So how could you justify something like that at that point? So when you see that, you know they're trying to advance an agenda. When you have different things in schools where they will treat kids differently on the basis of their skin color and say one skin color is an oppressor, one's an oppressed. Yeah, that may not be under a course titled CRT, but it's the same type of outlook and way to teach other subjects. Also on the gender ideology, there are absolutely school districts around the country that have guidance in place about teachers saying to very young kids, hey, you may have been born in a boy's body, but maybe you're not really a boy. So that is absolutely going on throughout the country. And quite frankly, we wouldn't have gotten the media and the left to be so upset with our parents' rights in education if it wasn't going on. Because if it's not going on, then why would you care about it? So it is going on, and they just need to be honest about that. And they also retreat. They'll say, Hugh, they'll say, oh, it's not happening. But then if it's happening, it's not a big deal. And then we should just not worry about it. Well, I mean, you got to pick your position here.
So they go with, it's not my dog, it didn't bite you, besides you kicked it first, replied. Governor, before I move to Charlie Crist, and he's decided to throw in with the Soros unprosecutors, this morning Rishi Sunak, who wants to be prime minister, he's not going to be prime minister, said it was a mistake during the lockdowns in Great Britain to trust the scientists so much, to cede power to them. Obviously, you did not do that. Is it encouraging to find conservatives in Great Britain admitting that they made that mistake?
I think it's essential that that happen. And I just went back to Eisenhower's farewell address, where in addition to warning about the military-industrial complex, he said, you know, as scientific research becomes melded with government policy, there's a danger that public policy itself could be captive to what he termed a scientific technological elite. And he rejected that because he said a statesman has got to consider that, but you also have all these other factors that you need to harmonize. And so you see things like Fauci saying, oh, there's no lasting damage from these school closures. Give me a break. I mean, I can tell you because I've had families move to Florida just for that issue, and there was a myopic focus on one respiratory pathogen to the exclusion of everything else, which is very, very damaging. But then there was also mitigations applied that were not capable of doing what they said. I mean, the fact of the matter is, by the time we got into April of 2020, it was pretty clear that this thing had already spread enough. You weren't going to be able to eradicate it through lockdown policies. And I think the dangerous thing is very few people in the public health establishment have been willing to acknowledge those mistakes. And that just means that we could potentially repeat some of those mistakes sometime in the future.
Last question, Governor DeSantis. You have been gifted with Charlie Crist as an opponent in your reelection campaign. He began his campaign by embracing Andrew Warren, the prosecutor you rightly suspended. What do you make about that? I think Americans are sick of prosecutors who don't prosecute.
Well, the defund the police movement was very damaging. But, Hugh, I think if you look at the body toll and the crime that has happened from these Soros-backed prosecutors who just decide they're not going to prosecute laws they don't like, I think it's probably even exceeded that. It's been very, very damaging. It is really torn at the fabric of society in a lot of these communities. And so, no, a prosecutor is not a law unto himself. You take an oath to faithfully apply the law. In Florida, under Article 4, Section 7 of our state constitution, the governor has the authority to suspend people who are not following the law. So that's what he did. But I think this is part and parcel of Charlie Crist's latest identity, which is that he said he wants to reallocate funding away from police. He's taken votes in Congress that are more consistent with the defund movement than pro-law enforcement. And now he's embracing these Soros prosecutors, which obviously will be very detrimental for our society. And the interesting thing is when we announced the suspension of Andrew Warren, I had all three sheriffs, his county sheriff and then two neighboring county sheriffs, and I had the former Tampa police chief all standing up there with me saying what a lousy job he's doing because he's not enforcing the law. And so the law enforcement community understood the stakes of having somebody in that position that is not faithfully enforcing the law.
Coming up, the president announces his plan for student loan debt forgiveness.
What kind of a lesson are we teaching young people?
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. On Wednesday this past week, the president made a formal announcement of his plan to give up to $20,000 back to students with student loan debt. That's millions of students across the country, many of them very wealthy, many of them professionals, many of them from the upper class whose parents could easily have written the check.
We're taking an economically responsible course.
The price tag for this latest episode in profligate spending is estimated at some $300 billion. Another $300 billion that will be passed along to you, the American taxpayer. Economist Stephen Moore joined Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago.
We are living in a fantasy land, folks. This administration is going to bankrupt our country. The idea that we're going to pay people's I love this term, forgiveness.
Yeah.
Don't you love that term?
Like they committed a crime. We forgive you.
Their sin of going to college.
But here's,
and by the way, how many, let's just get right down to the crux of this. How many people in the future do you think will ever repay a student loan?
Well, wait, no. See, I paid student loans. I was making my first job, I made $10,000 a year. And I still, I just made sacrifices so that I could pay my student loan because that's what I signed up to do. And that builds character.
And now
my kids are like, no, this is great, Bernie. This is the Bernie Sanders, you know, vision. Yeah. That's why all the young kids like Bernie Sanders, because they don't want to have to pay off this debt. And we shouldn't forget them because they signed up, they agreed to pay for it in the first place.
And also, I mean, I think this is a great point. Like, if Amy Jacobson can pay for her worthless degree from Iowa, everybody else can pay for their worthless degree too.
So, I mean, this is really the crux of the matter, though. You know, because my wife was in the same situation when she went to UCLA. She had loans, and she didn't make a whole lot of money when she graduated from college, and yet she, paid off the loan. And what kind of a lesson are we teaching young people? Yeah. You know, by the way, I'm having problems paying my mortgage. You guys think you could help me out on that? What about my credit card debt? That's pretty high, too.
Yeah.
So, Dan, you're not saying anything, Dan. Right. Can you help me out?
Yeah.
No, but I mean.
Well, we have a new rental assistance program in Chicago where 500 families get $500 a month. Just because. It's an election year.
There was an article in the New York Times about a year ago, and I cut it out, and it said, this was a Sunday New York Times headline. It said, Biden is proposing cradle-to-grave government. And really, that's what this is, folks.
Breaking news.
You know, Uncle Sam is going to take care of everything for you. You don't have to pay for that. It's all free.
The thing, too, is...
Modern monetary theory.
Yeah, what does it say about college, though? What are we trying to say about colleges? Are they fleecing people? Is this usurious? Is the federal government, since they control all student loans now, are they charging you serious interest rates? Are these bad people in charge of the federal student loan program, in charge of colleges, because they're doing bad things, right? Because that's why the government has to step in this relationship between the student and the college. So, doesn't this demand reforming a federal student loan program as well as colleges?
You would think so. I mean, look, there's not that much evidence that the student loan program has actually made college any more affordable to people, because it's every time they increase the amount of Pell Grants in these student loan programs, guess what the universities do? They raise their tuition. Why do you think it is that over the last 25 years that the student tuition costs have outpaced the inflation rate by 300%. And it's because, the government keeps giving more money to the universities keep raising their tuition. And then you wonder, and by the way, if somebody should be the co-conspirators in this debt crisis, because what is it? What's the number, Dan? Like $1.5 trillion of outstanding student debt?
Yeah.
Why aren't they held responsible for this?
My friend with Mike Gallagher was not impressed with the latest from President Biden.
I'm not kidding you. I am absolutely infuriated that this is going to happen. And you know what's even crazier? Is that Americans' heads aren't exploding over this. $900 billion you and I have to pay? So that little deadbeat dingbat from Queens or wherever the hell she's from, AOC, can lead the charge? Elizabeth Warren and all the rest of these lunatic, radical communists can tell everybody else we got to pay somebody else's college debt? And now Biden, in a desperate effort to win votes come midterm because they're going to get their butts kicked, is got this scheme? It's a mystery why President Biden has waited so long to do. He's waiting to the last possible minute to get as close to the midterm election as he can because he's buying votes. They don't earn votes over at the Democrat side of things. They buy them. They buy them. And they think between the Supreme Court rescuing babies' lives, which is what the court did, the Roe v. Wade decision, and this scheme, They think they're going to hold control of the House and the Senate. And you know what's sickening? It might work. It might work. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm begging you, I'm in no mood to hear from somebody who wants to explain why life is hard and they don't want, and you don't want to pay back your kid's college tuition bill, your college debt. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I am truly sorry if things have been challenging for you. You don't get to be a deadbeat. I'm sorry. You don't get to stiff the entity you owe a debt to. Forgiveness. This crap started with that shrew Hillary Clinton. College for tuition, forgiveness. Canceled debt. There's no canceled debt. There's no tooth fairy that makes it go away. This is going to cost the taxpayers who pay our bills hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't have anything to do with you not paying your kids' college debt. You're going to make me pay your kids' college debt? I hear from people every day. Look at Les online too from Vidalia, Georgia. He just finally paid college bills off. Took him 10 years to do so. 10 years. And you know what Les is? He's responsible. He's an adult. He's got respect for the way things are supposed to work. And you know things the way things are supposed to work? You don't get your car loan forgiven. You don't get your mortgage forgiven. You don't get to buy your wardrobe that you buy, your clothes that you don't. If you owe the department store a bill, you don't get it forgiven. You don't get your grocery bill forgiven. You don't get your electricity bill forgiven. You don't get to buy a pair of socks and decide you don't want to pay the department store the $3, so it's forgiven. You got to pay the department store the three damn dollars.
Coming up, key pieces for success.
For people who get at least a high school education, get a full-time job, and marry before having children, your chances of being in poverty are 3% or less.
Right.
With the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, Hugh will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Anxiety is one of the key issues motivating voters as we look ahead to November's election. And a key piece of that anxiety, particularly for urban voters, is crime. Non-prosecutors are part of the problem. Recidivism is part of the problem. And the defunding of our police and the general lack of support for law enforcement is part of the problem. But behind all of these things is a more fundamental piece fueling the crime and the related challenges we are seeing, the weakening of the American family. Pete Peterson from Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy joined Seth Leibson from AM 960 The Patriot in Phoenix.
We've gotten into this place where the discussion around family formation almost becomes, ipso facto, something off the table.
Right.
Right. We can't talk about it in polite company. If we're going to be about the science, in this case the social science, then we need to be able to have these serious conversations about there are indicators out there. We know what can create conditions of poverty. We know what can create conditions for antisocial behavior later in life. And we know what influences educational performance, and it's not just the school system.
Some of the things that have become taboo turn out in social policy to be the biggest issues that if we could get our hands and heads around would actually get to no longer nibbling on the edges, but actually solving our biggest of problems that seem unsolvable. Education deficits, welfare, crime, family formation, drug use. Pete, maybe there's a few other things on the list.
What I wanted to bring up is there is an interesting nexus here, specifically on the issue of education, right? Which is that those of us on the right, I think, are in the right place to be arguing about the various issues we're seeing in our K-12 education system, particularly the public education system. At the same time, most public educators at a certain point will say it can't just be on us.
Right.
Of interest is that, you know what, it really can't just be on you, mm-hmm. because you're just the end of the line for kids coming out of family situations that may actually inhibit academic performance.
That's right. That's right. And so the kid is trained in 5 to 12 years of an entire asocial situation before the teacher even sees them, right?
That's right. And obviously, as they progress through the K-12 system, there can be challenges outside of those 8 to 3 o'clock hours mm-hmm. that I think there could be an interesting nexus point, which is to say, Ian Rowe is right when he says, you know, what's been called the success sequence, right, which is this three-step formula that for people who get at least a high school education, get a full-time job, and marry before having children, your chances of being in poverty are 3% or less.
Right.
But again, there could be an interest, and I know Ian is trying to do it through his charter schools as he tries to weave in this content along with the reading, writing, and arithmetic to say that, yeah, we need to understand that the school is one part of a kid's day and the other things that are going on can impact that child's performance. And those things really do relate directly to family formation. And we should be taking those things seriously, understanding we may not be able to do a lot about it, but at least we should be able to make the children and parents aware that their behavior does, sounds silly to say this, but that their behavior does have an impact on their child's performance and chances of future success.
There does seem to be a younger generation of teachers that are saying, oh no, we want to be there in place of the parents. You see this play out a lot in this whole debate about sexual assignment and gender affirmation.
The broader philosophy of education, which is being taught about this view that the goal of education is to free students from the restrictions of tradition,
right,
often articulated through family and faith.
Right.
And so in that, the teachers are seen as the ones that are automatically at odds with certainly traditional family and traditional moral inculcating institutions. And so I think you do raise a fair point. I just wonder at the same time, as we continue to see, especially here in California, continuing poor performance by our educational institutions on, as borne out by literacy rates and so forth, that if we were to get a clearer sense of the connection there between educational performance and family formation, whether there couldn't be a connecting point made to say that even for the most radical, that these the views that can be taught in schools that family formation doesn't matter are just toxic.
Yeah.
Coming up,
there's not as much courage in Washington as I would have expected, but there were a lot of amazing people who were willing to engage in discussions.
Jared Kushner, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
Jared Kushner has released his memoir, one that was much awaited in Washington, D.C., because very few people, if anyone other than President Donald Trump, knows what went on in the West Wing for 4 years under President Trump than Jared Kushner. The book, Breaking History, focuses, of course, on the Abraham Accords, of which Jared Kushner was one of the chief architects, and the First Step Act, which would never have passed had Jared Kushner not been pushing for it every step of the way. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. The only time I heard from you during the presidency is when you were lobbying people, including media members, to pass the First Step Act. I am not surprised to find that Mitch McConnell thought you were the best lobbyist in Washington, D.C.
So I was reaching out to yourself and anyone else who had a voice. We took what we thought was an ember approach, where anytime there was a voice of dissent against the bill that was based on misinformation, our opponents were very formidable, but they were spreading a lot of misinformation about the bill, and we had to jump on it right away. What they were saying is that this bill would release violent felons from prison, and that's a pretty hard thing to argue against if it gets out. But unfortunately, or fortunately, that wasn't what the bill actually did. What the bill was doing was it was bringing job training programs into the prison so that people who were in the prisons would get, you know, training, and they'd get mental health treatment and drug addiction treatment, so that they went out of prison, they would actually have a chance to reenter society and not go back to prison. The recidivism rate, meaning people who left prison and committed crimes, was in the 70% range. And so we knew where a lot of our future crimes were coming from. So we just had to take these people and get them onto the right track in order to make community safer. So we were calling anyone who had the wrong information to try to get them down. Now, with McConnell, there's a scene I write about in the Oval Office where he comes to tell the president, sorry, we're not going to have a chance to get Jared's bill done, and we just don't have time in the calendar. And so Trump calls me into the Oval Office, and McConnell, you know, Trump says, Mitch, you have to tell Jared the news. I don't have the heart. He's been working on this so hard for 2 years. And McConnell says to me, he says, look, I have to say, Jared's one of the best lobbyists I've seen. He's had every single donor and person I know call me. And I said to him, well, that's not true. I have a lot of people who haven't called you yet. So what I was doing was basically stalking him and figuring out, you know, which events he was going to be at, which donors he was having dinner with. And I was calling all of them in advance and saying, can you please pressure him to give me some floor time so that we can get this bill done? We accomplished like 20 different hurdles. And then, you know, without the floor time, though, we were dead. So it just shows there's no partial credit in politics. Good intentions doesn't really mean much. And I really show in this book and with this example how legislation can get passed, and that the system that our founding fathers designed is a brilliant system. And if you work it hard, you can get big changes done. But I think it shouldn't be easy to make big changes in our government. And that's why you have to work hard, build consensus, talk to people across the aisle, and occasionally lobby hard even people on the same side of the aisle as you.
A dinner with Senators Durbin and Klobuchar and Bob Corker and Susan Collins. That is very granular level stuff, Jared. And laws don't get passed unless that happens.
So that was my assumption as an outsider, right? So I was from the business sector, and in business sector, you have to make deals, right? How do you make deals? You don't do it just by talking to your allies. You do it by talking to the person on the other side. And it's okay to have disagreements. That's okay. But our goal was to try to identify what are we all trying to achieve? And then if we could get commonality on that objective, then it was about having a lot of different ideas on how to get there and finding ways where we thought we could all support it. And obviously navigating the different politics, because, you know, again, when we started this process, Akeem Jeffries and Van Jones, you know, were reaching across the aisle to work with me on it, and they were getting, you know, called horrible names. I mean, Van Jones was being called an Uncle Tom on Twitter for working with Trump. Akeem Jeffries was getting pressure from Rep. John Lewis and others, you know, in the Congressional Black Caucus, who were saying, don't work on this. We don't want to give Trump a victory here. But they both said, you know, if there's an opportunity to do something that we believe in that's good, we're going to engage in conversations. And so, you know, there's not as much courage in Washington as I would have expected, but there were a lot of amazing people who were willing to engage in discussions. And that dinner I try to take people through is how we kind of came together and said, okay, we're all going to work together in good faith. And we kept the trust. And that's why, again, the people who worked with me knew that the conversations never made it to the press. We were able to have disagreements privately, but it was always constructive, and it was never personal. It was about trying to find the best policies to work things forward. But I write a lot about those interactions with Democrats because, again, I hate when I see people saying, oh, Washington's not like it used to. It's so much more divisive. I think it's always been divisive, but I think that it takes the courage of the people in power to come together, be bigger than the moment, work across the aisle, and try to get things done. And the first step back ended up with 87 votes. I give it an asterisk because Burr voted against it because he was pissed at Tim Scott on a judicial issue, and Lindsey Graham was in Afghanistan, so both should have voted for it, so we should have been at 89, but 87 was still a pretty good outcome.
Let me start with Yousef Al-Ataibi. I know Yousef. It's a big play by Yousef to stop an annexation. It also made possible the Abraham Accords. The granular detail in here is just remarkable, but that op-ed, very few people know about that.
So first of all, Yousef is a giant. And, you know, I saw in Washington, you know, there are different kind of ambassadors. Some of them were there just to try to show cocktail, to do cocktail parties. Yousef was one of the most effective, thoughtful, just great people who I encountered who really understood how Washington worked and how to be constructive. I mean, his country, the United Arab Emirates, is one of the great allies of America. They fought with us in six wars. They were the first Muslim country after America went into Afghanistan to say, we don't want this to be perceived as a war of the West against Islam. So we're going to join because this is a war of like-minded nations against radical extremism and terrorism. And so they've been a great ally to America, and Yousef has really been instrumental in building that. But with regards to the Abraham Accords, they would not have happened without him. He was an essential player. You know, a lot of people ask me when I left government, how did the Abraham Accords occur? And quite frankly, I couldn't really answer that question in a soundbite. And so what I tried to do in the book was just go through all the different things that led up to the conditions that were created in order for it to occur. And I tell people we succeeded on Plan C, but only because we went through the alphabet three times with ideas that failed. And one thing we kept learning from our different experiences on how to find pathways forward. And again, President Trump gave us the directive to find a way forward. And so, you know, failure was not an option and quitting was not an option. And so I really try to take the readers on my journey as somebody who had no diplomatic experience and wasn't even deep in the conflict as to coming in it with an outsider's perspective, a fresh approach, and trying to use common sense and not being stuck in the history or the way that a lot of the professors or the previous negotiators had looked at it. I tried to just look at it for what it was and then how do we push people forward? I felt like peace is about the future, and it's very easy to get stuck in a conflict because of the past. But fundamentally, the job of leaders is probably number one, to keep their people safe, and then number two, to give their people opportunity. And I use that as a premise to say, okay, what are the right things that leadership should be doing in order to accomplish those objectives? And that was the framework that I tried to approach the problem with.
Coming up.
They're taking away the American dream from our children, and this country is worth fighting for.
Maya Flores, a candidate for Texas's 34th congressional district. In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Don Crow. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, the president celebrates the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act.
With this law, the American people won and the special interests lost.
We'll look at how the bill amends an Obamacare provision.
This harmful new rule could force physicians to perform abortions.
A father pushes back against a school district that undermined parental authority and sought to facilitate the gender transition of his daughter.
Our daughter was living a double life without our consent or knowledge.
So why are we pushing so hard in this direction?
The United States is going the opposite direction of the rest of the world.
Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. One House seat and one new Congresswoman in particular is enormously strategic. That's Maya Flores. You might remember her. In June, she won a special election for Texas' 34th Congressional District. She is the first member ever of Congress who was born in Mexico. Her husband is a Border Patrol agent. And she's a threat to Democrats because, of course, she's a Republican. Congresswoman Maya Flores was a guest on my program. There's a great personal story, Congresswoman. Tell people your background and how you came to be.
Well, I was born in Burgos, Tamaulipas, Mexico. It's about 2.5 hours from my current home right now, and blessed to come here to the United States when I was 6 years old. Both my parents were migrant workers. I was a migrant worker myself at the age of 13, continued my education, became a respiratory care practitioner, a proud Border Patrol wife. I'm a mother. And accomplish the American dream here in the United States. And I want to make sure that our children have the opportunities that I had as well. And if someone like myself can accomplish so much, I want to make sure that our children do as well. And I just feel that under this administration and the Democrat Party, they're taking away the American dream from our children. And this country is worth fighting for. I just want to give back to this amazing country that's done so much for me.
Congresswoman Flores, I did not know that you were a Border Patrol spouse. And that, of course, means you know the issue better, at least as well as anybody else. Your first piece of legislation, which is a border piece of legislation, sort of exemplifies your mission. Tell people about that.
It's so important that we focus on border security. Border security is an issue that is important, not just here for South Texas, but for the entire country. Unfortunately, a lot of people on the Democrat Party are not supportive of border security and understanding that the policies that this administration is putting in is causing the influx of people coming in. I really do think that border security shouldn't be about Democrat or Republican. It really frustrates me because this is something that we should all want, right?
Yeah, well, Congresswoman Flores, you're the first Mexican-born female naturalized American in the Republican Party in Congress. I'm just so happy for this development because
Thank
it's where
you.
The party has to go. And I hope people across
Amen.
The country realize that, right?
I do feel that they do know that. It's so important that we get more Hispanics to run the Republican Party. That's the only way we're going to end identity politics, because I hate identity politics. The only way to end it is by getting more Hispanics into the Republican Party so we can end it and just focus on the person and the values and not focus on where they're from or the color of their skin. None of that should matter.
But you represent a political existential threat to the Democrats. They really have to get rid of you, Myra Flores.
I am everything that they claimed that they were for and that they supported, and yet I've only received hate from them.
Thank you for joining us today. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. If you haven't signed up for our podcast yet, why not take a minute to do so? Go to townhallreview.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producer David Pashon, Michael Cook, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.